Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Daryl Geist. He's Habitat Coordinator for Buffalo Field Campaign, a position he's worked in for 15 years. His experience with the Yellowstone Buffalo dates back to the early 90s when he worked with Cold Mountain, Cold Rivers, and videographer Mike Meese to publicize the state of Montana's slaughter of these majestic wild animals. After graduating from college, he migrated to Montana, a habitat he dearly loves, from his home state of South Dakota. So first, thank you as always for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me on.
So today we're going to talk about Buffalo and the Endangered Species Act. But before we talk about the Endangered Species Act, can you talk about, give a brief introduction to buffalo to people who may not know much about them?
Sure. Well, bison have inhabited North America, various species for the last 200,000 years. And the modern species we see today, bison, plains bison, wood bison up north, these are the, you know, the descendants of this historical species that inhabited North America for a very, very long time. And it did not take long, but essentially you had the largest distribution of any ungulate, one of the most abundant species in all of North America, the buffalo, reduced to 1,000 animals in the late 1800s after this intense market hunting campaign that eliminated them from nearly all of their range. And it was about one third of North America. And the numbers have been banded back and forth, but you're looking at minimum several million buffalo, you know, up to 30 million, across about 22 different unique, ecosystems from the Arctic tundra in the north to the Chihuahua desert in the south. To the swamplands, to across Louisiana into Florida, Appalachia Mountains, the Midwest, all of the short grass, all of the prairies, short grass, mixed grass, tall grass prairies, and the Intermountain region, the Continental Divide, also bison were also inhabiting that region. So it was a vast area inhabited by one of the most abundant ungulates ever, and it didn't take long. And I was looking over some notes I took, and it was really post Civil War. There was a 20-30 year period in which, you know, the market hunting dramatically just wiped them out. It was really that brief period of time where the last of these bison were just decimated, and it didn't take long. Ironically, the buffalo hides that were being hunted and marketed back to the factories were used to run those facilities, because the buffalo hide was tough and durable, and literally the buffalo hides ran the industrial factories that were contributed to their demise across North America.
Yeah, weren't they used as belts for the various machinery?
Conveyors. That's right. That's right. The very tough, like I said, very tough, durable hides, and they were able to run the industrial factories faster using a more durable hide that was gotten from the buffalo. So today, you know, just to bring this up to speed, it's like right now, and I'm speaking of the wild buffalo. I'm not talking about commercial, domestic, privately held buffalo. I'm talking about the wild buffalo. And just a few quick things. They're extinct in 99% of their original range. In the United States, they're regionally extinct in 40 states, and possibly Texas. And they've been reduced to less than 1% of their former numbers. Literally, there's less buffalo in the wild than there are polar bears in the wild. And another comparison, grizzly bears. Grizzly bears have lost about 98% of their original range, and they've recovered some. But bison have lost more range than listed grizzly bears, and their numbers are less in the wild than there are polar bears. So we're swimming upstream. We're, you know, and trying to gain protection for this remnant population of buffalo in the wild that exists in the Yellowstone ecosystem. And it's been quite the fight, and we continue to wage that battle in the courts and also in the public mind. Just, we don't think people understand how perilous the condition is for these buffalo in the wild, and there's very few that are actually intact and retain their identity as buffalo, because 100 years ago, ranchers wanted to provide a livelihood for these buffalo, so they crossbred them in confinement with cattle, and so there's this legacy of cattle DNA in most bison herds today, and that includes the privately held bison, Custer State National Park, Wind Cave National Park. There's several park herds, you know, the very small, isolated ranges, fenced in for the most part, rounded up, vaccinated, essentially treated like livestock. So there's this legacy of cattle DNA in bison that was, you know, from these experiments that were over a century ago. And by the way, the Canadians, crossbred cattle and bison in confinement up until the 1960s, early 1970s. So there was all of this experimentation underway to crossbreed these animals. Why? Because they wanted to exploit the versatility, the resiliency of the wild buffalo and its ability to survive in fairly extreme conditions. And they also wanted to, you know, see if they could produce some meat that was more sellable, marketable. So the bison had been overutilized for commercial purposes, and this legacy is widespread. And the reality is, we don't know, the scientists don't know what kind of impact it has on the bison, but it permanently displaces the bison genome. And there's been one or two studies that show that these bison that have this, carry this legacy of cattle DNA are smaller, and they may be more susceptible to mitochondrial disease, because the cattle genome eclipses the bison genome in a place where the energy cell lives, so that mitochondrial DNA, the energy cell, has been displaced permanently. I cannot undo this. You cannot go back and reconstruct this DNA. So here we have, I mean, essentially one population of intact wild buffalo still inhabiting their original range. And this is, you know, for last 11,000, 13,000 years. I mean, this is the only legacy of wild buffalo in their original habitat that we have in the United States. So this is a really, truly unique herd of buffalo that deserve more than the way the Yellowstone National Park is treating them, and the state of Montana as well.
So let's talk for a moment before we go to Endangered Species Act and what's going on with that. Let's talk for a moment about the last 30 years of history of the buffalo in Yellowstone, and their treatment by the Park Service and by Montana, Idaho, etc.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the state of Montana, back in the early 90s, decided that they wanted to get control over these bison in Yellowstone because they were, quote, migrating outside Yellowstone National Park. So they passed a law, and Montana Code annotated 81-2-120, and it essentially gives displaced Fish and Wildlife Parks completely from the management scheme and gave the Department of Livestock Management authority over these buffalo migrating into the state. And there's no conservation provision in that law, period. It's all quarantine, capture, vaccinate, you know, hunt through the after the state vet gives their approval. But it's all a take. The statute itself is designed to take the animals. There's no conservation.
By which you mean kill.
Provision in there. Kill. Kill, quarantine, haze, harass, vaccinate, reduce to quarantine, capture facilities, slaughterhouses. So the state, once they passed this law, once the livestock industry got this law passed, they turned around and sued Yellowstone National Park based upon it. And it forced everything into court, and then there was an agreement out of court between Yellowstone National Park and the state of Montana to put in place what's called the Interagency Bison Management Plan. But essentially, it's a plan on behalf of the state of Montana based on state law. And this is the framework under which these wild buffalo have been mismanaged for well over, it's about 20 years now.
So, you know, I've worked with Buffalo Field Campaign for a long time, and I've known about some of the things you're saying, but actually it just occurred to me, what happened when the buffalo migrated back in the 60s and 70s and 50s and 40s? Did they not get shot then, or were they still getting shot when they left the park?
Yeah, there was migration going back to when there were very small numbers. And that, by the way, that entire population that we count today was reduced to about 23 buffalo in the wild. And there's always been migration. They continue to migrate. It's part of their nature. And the state is trying to treat them as a Yellowstone National Park bison, that they belong in Yellowstone National Park and that's it. But the ecosystem is far more expansive than the park, and the greater Yellowstone is like 22 million acres. A lot of it is public lands, national forests, national parks, wildlife refuges. It's a huge complex. And bison have been reduced to just a very small portion of the ecosystem. And the state's position is that, you know, they're Yellowstone National Park bison. And beware of that language, because if they're Yellowstone National Park bison, then what are they doing outside the park, right? So they've been getting they've been migrating on various population levels, under various management regimes for a very long time. And it's not a new occurrence, but you're right. The reaction to this migration, natural migration of buffalo in the ecosystem, by the state of Montana was to pull out the rifle and shoot them dead. That was essentially the main management action that was in place for a very long time, up until this management plan was put in place after the state of Montana ceded Yellowstone National Park. And then it shifted. It shifted inside Yellowstone National Park. Now you have Yellowstone National Park capturing buffalo for slaughter inside Yellowstone National Park at Stevens Creek. And Yellowstone National Park has become the largest source of mortality for buffalo in the ecosystem. You have thousands of buffalo captured for slaughter under this plan and shipped off to slaughterhouses.
And before we go to the Endangered Species Act, this is a question I think I've asked you before, and I can't remember the answer, I'm sorry, that let's say humans disappeared, and I want to know about buffalo migration, that with the buffalo in Yellowstone, you know, the buffalo went all the way from the Chihuahua Desert up to the tundra, and were they like birds that they would the one from the tundra, if they're at the tundra at the far north, would they only go a couple hundred miles south and a different buffalo would go a couple hundred miles more south? Or would one herd, if you removed humans from this picture entirely and you gave it 300 years so the buffalo can start expanding, would these particular buffalo and their descendants, would this particular herd merely migrate 100 miles, or would this particular herd migrate all the way down to Colorado, all the way down to Oklahoma? Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah, it's.
Do we even know?
It's difficult. There you go. It's difficult to reconstruct. But just based on common sense, and availability of forage, adequate water, these buffalo would migrate hundreds of miles in any given season, and over one lifetime, one generation of buffalo, 20 years in the wild, it could be much more. It could be 500, it could be 800, it could be 1,000 miles. These are buffalo will do what they want, and generally speaking, they'll migrate wherever they need to migrate. And then the ecosystem, just to back up and give people a perspective, if you look at Yellowstone National Park on a map, we know there's migrations eastward into following the Shoshone River into Wyoming. We know there are migrations southward. We know there are migrations westward up and over through Hebgen Basin and up and over the Targhee Pass into Idaho and Henry's Lake caldera, which is on the other side of the divide. And we know they migrate north through the Gardner Basin following the Yellowstone River. So you essentially have, even today, you have migration, a natural migration of buffalo in the ecosystem, moving in every direction, following the major river corridors and climbing mountains and climbing passes to get to habitat. So mountains are not a barrier to migration. These buffalo climb mountains for breakfast. If they think there's a nice meal waiting for them, they'll climb that mountain to get to it. So even today, there's this remnant migration that's jeopardized, by the way, because all of those buffalo migrating into the states are met with some pretty horrible codes on the books. Wyoming limits buffalo to just a couple areas, the Teton Wilderness in the south of Yellowstone National Park. But it's all to hunt. So Wyoming, instead of Wyoming, manages for limited numbers, limited range, and it's designed to remove them all. In Idaho, when we know buffalo migrate into Idaho over Targhee Pass, heading towards Henry's Lake caldera, Idaho is essentially says, we will eradicate these buffalo. That's the statute. It calls for their eradication. And the state of Montana, I just explained some of the code earlier, there's no conservation provision. It's all designed to limit the range of buffalo migrating into the state, limit their numbers, and essentially manage for zero. That's the whole goal of state law. So these buffalo that are migrating in every direction in the ecosystem run into these state codes that have no conservation provision in them at all. And remember, I just mentioned how Yellowstone National Park, inside Yellowstone National Park, buffalo are being slaughtered, captured by the thousands. It's the largest source of mortality. So there is no regulatory mechanism. There's none. There's no regulatory mechanism to protect these buffalo at all, period.
Well, that seems like a great segue into the Endangered Species Act, because isn't the Endangered Species Act pretty much aimed precisely at circumstances like this, where you have it's the last line of protection for a creature that is critically imperiled?
Yeah, threatened or endangered with extinction. Yes. The answer is yes, Derek, but we've been fighting. You know, we just passed our fifth year anniversary, because it was November 14th, 2014, a Buffalo Field Campaign and Western Watersheds Project filed our petition to list the bison, a distinct population segment of Yellowstone bison, under the Endangered Species Act.
Okay, let's back up for a second and talk about, like, people might not know what listing means. They might not know how the process works. So can you give a 5-minute introduction to the Endangered Species Act, how it's supposed to work and how it works in reality?
You're going to be very disappointed to hear this, but any person can petition the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service to list a species. And you submit a petition, and within that petition, you provide substantial information to the service, saying any one of five factors, and the statute has five of them: loss of range, for example, you know, inadequate regulatory mechanisms, overutilization, other natural or man-made factors. You get the idea. So you present your petition and your substantial information to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and here's the evidence that any one of these five factors may threaten or endanger this species in the wild. You know, please give us a finding. And the service, and generally speaking, you can't sit back on your heels and wait for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to answer your petition. You have to sue them. You have to litigate. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they're required by law to give you an answer to your 90-day petition to list a species. You have to sue to get it. But if you get a negative finding, it essentially puts you back at square one. If you get a positive finding, you move to the next step under the Act, which is a 12-month species status review. And it's open to the public. Public can contribute evidence, comments. It's peer-reviewed. But essentially, it takes a big-picture look at all of the factors that may threaten or endanger a species in the wild. And if you'll have to litigate, you'll have to litigate to get the answer to the 12-month status review, in the eventuality you get it and there's a positive, you know, yes, this species is, you know, threatened or endangered in the ecosystem, then you essentially have to spend a lot of time protecting habitat for that species, working through all of the regulatory framework that's in place to try and get critical habitat designated. It's a very long process. I mean, it's taken about 15 years, if you're litigating every step of the way to successfully list a petition, successfully list a species based on a petition you submitted under the Endangered Species Act. It's about 15 years.
So I just want to make a comment that it's always struck me as completely insane and horrific that, first off, we have to petition. I mean, that's their job. And why do we even have to petition them in the first place? Why do we have to sue them to get them to do their job? My why is rhetorical, of course, but this has been something that has frustrated me for 30 years. And I can't remember who it was, whether it was Ansel Adams or David Brower or somebody had this famous line about what does it mean when we have to sue the government to protect wild nature? That's just, and especially, this is not even like suing the Corps of Engineers. Sorry that my voice is getting thin and reedy, but this just makes me mad. This is not even like the Corps of Engineers, whose job is to destroy rivers, really. This is Fish and Wildlife, whose supposed job is to protect fish and wildlife, but of course that's not true.
Yeah, it just makes me mad. It's a national mandate. It's a national mandate. And, you know, once a species is listed, threatened or endangered, all federal agencies have a mandate, a duty, to use their authorities to help recover that species. And so I think that's partially an answer to your question. They have to do something to help recover a threatened or endangered species in the wild. All of the federal government, every agency that has some authority, you know, over habitat or the species migration, they have to do something. And they don't want to do anything.
I'm presuming, though, and I've known some people in Fish and Wildlife who care deeply about fish and wildlife, who care about wild nature, and yet the institution, it just really bothers me.
Degraded.
Yeah, go ahead.
Degraded. It's been corrupted. It's been co-opted.
Yeah.
It's been, you know, politically, you know, neutered. it's underfunded. Congress... You know, this comes back on Congress. Congress enacted this statute. Congress needs to fund it, needs to step up, strengthen the provisions, but fund it above all. You know, is it really that expensive, you know, to protect and recover a species that need our help? You know, there's supposed to be all of these benefits involved in doing so. And there's this great reluctance on the part of Congress to fully fund this agency. I mean, boots on the ground, you know, people on the ground actually doing things that are of benefit to species, particularly on habitat. And because so much of it has been degraded and fragmented, and, you know, species are living in isolation. A cascade of adverse effects are happening in the ecosystem. We've allocated so much to human use and human development, there's hardly anything left for these species to have a chance of surviving. And it's been no different for the buffalo. We've had to litigate the whole way, and like I said, we just reached our fifth year anniversary on our 90-day petition. We're still in the 90-day stage.
Let's see, 5 years is, 1,800 days later? So you're in the 90-day phase, 1,800 days later?
We're still, and we're heading back to court.
Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
We're headed back to court again. You know, just a brief history, we filed our petition November 2014. We had to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington, D.C. We prevailed in court. Judge Christopher R. Cooper issued his opinion saying, look, you cannot use... They applied the wrong evidentiary standard to our petition. And at the 90-day stage, it is, does this factor, is it may threaten them or may endanger them? It's not is a threat or is endangerment. It's just enough evidence that it may threaten them in the wild, may endanger them in the wild. And the judge said, you applied this standard at the wrong evidentiary standard, a heightened evidentiary standard. And the judge said, that's illegal. You can't do that. And among other things. And he was also chastised the agency for picking and choosing, scientists and, crediting this, but, discrediting this that we presented in our petition. And he says, I'm sorry, you can't, it's based on what the reasonable person would consider, substantial information. If there's disagreement among scientists, then you should credit that evidence from the petition. You can't dismiss it just because there's a disagreement, because the reasonable person could arrive at both, right? So at the 90-day stage, it's may threaten, may endanger. It was a good decision, and we had to file. We waited. We were hoping the agency, we thought they would, within months of Judge Cooper's order, that they would give us another 90-day finding, this time finding in favor of our petition and then advancing to the next step. Agency did not give us another 90-day finding, per Judge Cooper's order, by the way. So we had to file another complaint in Cooper's court, which finally got the agency off its heels. And they said, oh yeah, we'll get you another 90-day finding. Well, they gave it to us in September, and they essentially redid exactly what Judge Cooper nailed them on his previous ruling. They picked and choose, disagreements. They tried to resolve disagreements among scientists. It looks like they're still trying to apply this higher evidentiary standard. And, to be honest, I have to read this stuff. And I was reading the service's finding from September 2019, and I was struck. I was like, this could have been written by a cattle rancher writing for Rangeland magazine. Because it was far below what I would expect, like a professional, biologist would render, in an opinion. It was just very frustrating, and there was just a serious bias in the agency's negative 90-day finding.
This is,
for example, using the phrase Yellowstone National Park bison over and over and over again. It's like, I'm sorry, but there is no such thing as Yellowstone National Park bison. It's the bison have inhabited that ecosystem for thousands of years, long before Yellowstone National Park became a park, long before the states of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming became states.
I was just going to say, this is giving me flashbacks to when I used to file timber sale appeals, and just the sheer nonsense and the sheer gaslighting that you have to read through in their documents as they attempt to justify, in that case, clear cuts, and in this case, denying Endangered Species Act. So that's the thing. Make the argument right now for why buffalo should be an endangered species and why this population should be endangered. Aren't there a half million buffalo still around? I know I'm giving you the industry line. Said that they were genetically no longer pure bison, but why should these buffalo be covered under the Endangered Species Act?
Loss of range. We're looking at, as wildlife species, it's a 99% loss of range. And the Yellowstone ecosystem, it's at minimum 85% loss of range and habitat. And secondly, inadequate regulatory mechanisms. The response of the states to this natural migration of the species in the ecosystem is to wipe them out. manage them in limited numbers, manage for removal, manage for zero genetic diversity of bison. That can't be sustained over time. And the reality is, there's the best available science says there's two genetically distinct subpopulations of bison. This is very important because the managers don't recognize that finding. Natalie Halbert and other scientists, it's a 2012 publication. So we have pretty small populations. When you look at this genetically distinct subpopulation numbers, the central interior bison have been in decline under the current management framework. From it's like 3,500 in 2008 to about 1,100, 1,200 today. So there's been this unexplained and dramatic decline in one of the genetically distinct subpopulations for which no one has offered an explanation, you know, a rationale, or even produced any evidence, you know, a study, you know, real data. What happened? What happened? You know, to these numbers of bison in the central interior. And this is a short period of time. And then to step back and a little bit more context here, you know, genetic variation. This is one of the reasons why Congress passed the Endangered Species Act. Protect, preserve genetic variation. And as a scientist, Heidrich, he published a peer-reviewed publication. He essentially said, look, if you do not have a census population of 3,000 buffalo, they're going to lose genetic diversity for certain. They're going to just lose genetic diversity. And this species has already lost enough. They were squeezed through this near extermination, genetically bottlenecked. And then most of them were exploited for, overutilized for commercial purposes in this crossbreeding, cattle and bison. So we don't know. I mean, we've got evidence that the population to maintain genetic variation over long periods of time, these population sizes, adults, reproductive adults, needs to be much larger than it is. And that's not going to happen if you draw a boundary beyond which buffalo cannot roam and have it enforced by the states or Yellowstone National Park. You know, there's all of these factors are coupling and they're complicating the factors that threaten these buffalo. And looking forward, right, let me bring a little bit more science into this. Looking forward, there was a publication by Martin, 2018. He was looking back at the historical body size of bison over when they've inhabited North America for the last 200,000 years. And he found that, I'm going to quote this, global climate change drives body size of bison species. That is, as temperatures warmed, bison became smaller. And then he went on to, because he was looking at evidence of these sizes of bison historically, they kept getting smaller, smaller, smaller. And then he looked forward. He says, well, what's going to happen if the temperatures continue to warm? What's going to happen to this body size? And he, let me quote again. He says, it is unclear whether bison can adopt body size to a 4 degrees Celsius warming within 10 generations by year 2100. In other words, buffalo, he says, buffalo somehow in this warming environment, warming climate, have to reduce their body size by half within 10 generations, about 80 years by the end of the century, to adopt to this dramatically abrupt changing new climate. You know, so just imagine that. You're looking a buffalo, you see them today, they're 2,000 pounds, they're 6 feet tall at the shoulder, you know, they're a massive animal. Somehow, they have to reduce their body size by half by the end of the century to adapt to this increasing temperature that Martin projects is going to happen. You know, what comes to mind when you hear that? I mean, what's going to happen to these buffalo if they have to be half the size they are today? Will they be able to protect themselves against grizzly bears, wolves? Will they be able to plow through the winter storm, right, that dumps 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet of snow? And this happens in the Yellowstone ecosystem. And while temperatures are plummeting to, you know, minus 40 degrees Celsius, right, which is the same as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, what kind of future is that? You know, can they even adopt body size fast enough to deal with these rising temperatures as a result of humans exploiting fossil fuels for our energy source? So there's a lot, I guess, there's a lot of threats here and now and on the horizon. And the service is not grappling with this evidence at all. It is not. They're just not putting it in their analysis, the rationale, the reasoning. I'm just not grappling with it. So we have forced back into court to, you know, get another order from Judge Cooper to force them to grapple with it. When will they grapple with these facts?
Well, I'll tell you something that makes me really angry about this entire conversation. My anger is not at you, obviously, but I think it's ridiculous that you and I are even having this discussion, because you had a population that was, in the tens of millions, and you now have a population, and we can't include those that are on feedlots for the same reason that you can't include, on pastures, for the same reason you can't include those tigers that are in zoos. I mean, that they don't really count. The wild population is what's important. And
that's right.
So you have a population that's gone from, I've heard higher numbers, I've heard 60 million, but let's say 30 million for now. You have a population that's gone from 30 million down to current wild population of buffalo is, give me a number, wild, genetically pure.
Genetically
in the United
intact.
States, because it doesn't, because Canada doesn't count for the Endangered Species Act.
Good point. In all of North America, there's about 11 to 13,000. In the United States, we've got one population in Yellowstone. It's about 4,500, roughly. About 1,100 in the Central Interior. The remainder in the Northern Range.
Conversation done. You had a population that went from 30 million to 4,500. We're done. Stamp it. Endangered. I don't understand. Sorry to sort of be jumping in and doing talking when you're supposed to be doing the talking, but this just makes me mad. It's just ridiculous that this is even a conversation. I'm sorry. Again, you had a population that's 30 million. It is currently 4,500 in the United States. What's there to talk about? What there is to talk about is how you help them recover. That's all there is to talk about.
That's what we're trying to make happen. And it's been very frustrating to repeatedly bash heads with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who's supposed to like make the decisions based on the best available science. You know, we're heading back to court after 5 years. We're still arguing over evidence in a 90-day petition 5 years later. And we're not going to get a decision until, if we're fortunate, sometime in 2020, if we're lucky. And then the agency will once again, what are they going to do this time? Are they going to drag their feet for a year, 6 months? You know, are they going to then, you know, let's project forward. We get into Judge Cooper's court. Cooper says, I thought I was very clear on the first case, and dings him again. says, you got to go back and apply, you know, use the law in a lawful manner and reach a reasonable conclusion about this 90-day petition to list the Yellowstone bison as endangered species. Let's say they do it again. You know, they issue another, they come back after delaying, foot dragging, they do it again. You know, they issue another negative 90-day finding. We're back to square one. We're back to this long, drawn-out court process where we have to follow these legal steps just to get into court, just to get a hearing. You know, they're dragging their feet, you know, while this threat is just hovering right over the buffalo. Every year it magnifies, you know, during the winter season.
Yeah. And another thing that always struck me when I was doing these timber sale appeals is that the people who were writing all these lies were making, in the 90s, $30,000 to $50,000 a year. And meanwhile, everybody, not everybody, but most of the people who were opposing these were either unpaid or were making about $15,000 a year. And I mean, all they're doing is bureaucratically wearing people down, because this is also, you know, I'm thinking about how can people help with this? And as soon as you say that you have to file lawsuits, it's all of a sudden becomes this fight that individuals have a more difficult time entering, because it's the realm of attorneys.
Right. Well, we are a campaign, and this is one of many things we do. You know, we are a field campaign. We are the backbone of our organization. Runs on volunteers who come from around the world to stand with the buffalo in the field. And we're in need of volunteers. You know, you can go to our website, buffalofieldcampaign.org. Under Get Involved, you'll see a volunteer section. We need volunteers in the field to help us watchdog what the government is doing, will be doing, against these buffalo as they migrate into the states. That's a really critical aspect of our campaign. I have to say
that the people I've known who've gone to Buffalo Field Campaign have said it's an absolutely life-changing experience, one of the best things I've ever done in their lives.
It's gorgeous, too. It's just beautiful. And to be able to see this like remnant population of wild buffalo in their original habitat migrating on the landscape, you know, through these 3-4 foot snows and, you know, at 40 below zero. Believe me, at 40 below zero, it's very pretty out. Anyway, it's this gorgeous ecosystem, just spectacular wildlife, and being able to just to witness that one event, you know, these real wild buffalo in their original habitat is just an amazing experience. And but there's so many ways, you know, that people can help us. You know, it's just one thing we do. You know, we're trying to put in place, you know, legal protections for the buffalo and the habitat that they need to survive, because there is none. You know, we're doing this by the means available to us. And, you know, it's just one of the things that we're doing. But in the meantime, we run this field campaign. It's really dependent on you, the people listening right now, and your friends, your family. You know, check us out. Check us out. Go on to our website, Buffalo Field Campaign, under Get Involved. Check us out. Volunteer.
Well, that is so great. And we have like 1 minute left. So is there any other wrap up you want to make about the Buffalo Field Campaign or anything?
There's lots of ways to help us out. You know, right now I just encourage people, you know, if you can spare $5 a month, you know, become a monthly donor. We need that kind of sustaining help. If you're a photographer, you have photos of the buffalo in Yellowstone, we would love to get them, because we put together this calendar. It's awesome. You know, if you have buffalo-inspired poems and poetry, we want that. You know, artwork, buffalo artworks and graphics, we want all of that. So if you're artistic, or send us material, contact us. We've got this calendar that uses the photos, the poems, the graphics, the art. We love that stuff. If you're a blogger, blog us, spread the word, you know, share our media posts, like us, spread the word. Contact our office coordinator, ask for some newsletters. You know, we'll send you free newsletters to help get the word out. You know, if you're got one of the fortunate few who inherited some cash, make us a beneficiary. We need long-term support. We need somebody with some big bucks to step up and help us out and sustain us. But above all, you know, volunteer if you can, spread the word, you know, contact us, check us out on the online, buffalofieldcampaign.org. There's lots of ways to contribute.
Well, thank you so much for your work in defense of the wild, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Daryl Geist. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Woo-hoo!